how do we lay foundations now at the hyper-local level that will pay off at the state and federal level in the next generation? And that's why I'm so passionate about community engagement, so passionate about community organizing. I think we, as scientists and healthcare providers, need to learn some big lessons from our community organizing friends. We need to bring in that knowledge. We need to learn some big lessons from our communication scientists, from our marketers, from political scientists, from folks that have studied the fall and rise of governments and mindsets, and not just ourselves and our go-to community partners. We need to expand those community partners and expand the interdisciplinary nature of our thinking to meet this moment. And so all of that future work really excites me.
Welcome to another episode of Advocates in Action, a podcast created by the Patient Advocate Foundation, a nonprofit that helps promote equitable access to affordable quality healthcare through providing case management services, financial assistance, and patient education and advocacy tools to people living with chronic, life-threatening, and debilitating illnesses. I'm your host, Ashley Freeman, Manager of Stakeholder Outreach and Engagement, and welcome to Season 10, where we get the opportunity to discuss what happens to patient care when equity and inclusion in healthcare are under threat. I'll be joined by some guests who can provide some hope to the troubling trends we are witnessing, including shifts in health policy, reduction of funding, limits on research priorities, and changes in clinical practices that threaten to dismantle hard-earned gains in health equity. Thank you so much, Dr. Philip Alberti, for joining me this season, where we are talking about holding the line, defending equity in healthcare. And I know that you recently published a perspective piece in the Milbank Quarterly titled Health Equity Benefits All Communities, Including White Ones. Tell us about this article, and really, why did you think that this was the perfect time to publish a piece like this?
Well, first, it's great to be here with you, Ashley. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity. At the heart, the paper is some of my own reflections and some proposed action steps about how folks like me and others in the community that are really committed to health equity and the goal of all communities thriving, how we can frame, communicate, and measure that goal in new ways, so that all people see themselves as beneficiaries of health equity. I'll give credit where credit is due. My husband had been prodding me to write something like this for some years. I think the initial seed for me actually goes back to 2021, when a former cabinet member published an anti-equity op-ed in the Washington Post. And in the title, that former cabinet member called the goal of health equity and the doing, the practice of health equity, racist. And that was astounding to me, thinking that it only applied to certain people and not to everybody, which is not how I think about health equity. And then in the body of that op-ed actually said that any equity is un-American. That's a quote, un-American, because we are focused on mandating equal outcomes as opposed to mandating or thinking about equal opportunity. Of course, equal opportunity is American as apple pie. For those of us in the health equity space that are guided in part by that lodestar definition from the CDC, health equity is a state where everyone has a fair and just opportunity, right? That word opportunity, the focus is baked in. And so there was a lot back in 2021 that rankled me about that op-ed and some of those false narratives. And as you pointed out in the framing of the question, we are now in this place where those false narratives are winning out, right? And that there are huge numbers among us that believe that for health equity to be achieved, that some communities have to lose for others to gain, that false zero-sum narrative, that we are exclusionary, that we aren't considering other people. None of that is true. I know you know none of that's true. I know none of that's true. But we've just done a really less than adequate job in our own, again, measurement framing discussion of our work. I think we've opened the door for some of those attacks and false narratives to take hold.
And what are some of the clear suggestions on how to combat that? And sometimes it's just a switch of language. So yes, expound upon that.
There are four main points. I think the first is about language. And I understand the existential nature of busting out your thesaurus and changing your words. I really do understand that there are some institutions, organizations, individuals that if they don't do that, lose livelihood, lights get turned off, etc. So it's a very real risk and threat. That said, I think that foundation of health equity and that phrase, the first recommendation is to stick by it, right? And actually open up that definition so we give more detail to what a fair and just opportunity for health looks like. Our Center for Health Justice at the AAMC has done a lot of polling to find areas of non-ideological kind of cross-racial agreement on the kinds of things that would create fair and just opportunities. One recommendation is don't abandon our language, but think about how to make our definitions more inclusive, even if we can't use that word, more inclusive and applicable to all. I have recommendations in there about measurement that we could explore and how the traditional way that we measure progress towards our goal of all communities thriving, even that can reinforce some of the false narratives. All of my papers always recommend deep and authentic community engagement to really listen and understand lived experience and bake that into hyper-local strategies. And then finally, there are many systems. Racism is one of them. There are many systems that impact, that mete out opportunity, that assign value to certain groups. And we should do a better job of making clear how some of those other isms, sexism, classism, heterosexism, etc., and some of the policies that reinforce those isms impact all of us, including maybe white folks that have been told they're not impacted by some of the health injustice in our nation.
And with including all of those isms, like you said, it creates more of a inclusive perspective so that everyone can identify with some way that they're being impacted. And so how do we find a balance between including all of these other isms while at the same time making sure that we don't minimize the disproportionate harm to communities of color and racism being the fundamental drive of health inequity? So inclusion without minimization.
100%. I'll emphasize your point and how much I agree with it. And then I make that exact same point in the paper that we can't abandon or water down this absolutely necessary focus on racism as a fundamental driver of disease and inequity. That is a truth. That said, I think we can, for lack of a better phrase, walk and chew gum at the same time, right? And, you know, I never not talk about racism. I always am talking about racism, but also, depending on who my audience is, I'm also maybe leading with classism or sexism. And of course, in the incomparable words of Dr. Kumari Jones, it is very clear that racism saps the strength of our whole society, right, through the waste of human resources. That is true. And I think for many white communities, not all, that's an indirect impact. I think we can do a couple of things by adding into our health equity conversation some of these other isms. So I think one, it's demonstrate that there are other systems of power at play that are having a much more direct impact on people that are racialized as white, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, those other isms don't only impact white communities, they also impact communities of color. And so it's also a way to build community across racial identity, right? It's not just white women on the losing end of sexism, right? And it's not just white queer people on the losing end of heterosexism. That is in and of itself kind of a silo buster when it comes to creating different communities across racial lines. So maintaining that focus, adding in a new focus, prioritizing how we enter into conversations about health equity, depending on the audience, and using some of these other isms as a way to build a larger cross-racial coalition. I think we can do it. We just have to get adept at opening up those conversations.
Are there any organizations or communities that you've seen that have been successful with building these coalitions and being more inclusive and just having a broader sense of equity and its impact on all people?
Yeah, an organization that I am just a huge fan of is We in the World. The We in the World Network. If you search We in the World and you can see some of their very hyper-local stories about how local communities centering their wisdom, centering their understanding of health and economic and other kinds of injustice, and building new on-the-ground coalitions that are really impactful. The biggest takeaway from that is the hyper-local nature of this work. I know we all want to find some magical national-level magic wand that will unite us all. I don't think that's our path for success. Mm. I think really understanding local dynamics to the neighborhood level, right? Having very intentional conversations and listening very actively, lived experience from the multiple communities that even exist in one neighborhood. I think that's how we build support for this movement for health equity and health justice from the bottom up. So it's less about scaling and spreading successes and more about this process of engagement and listening and collaborative action that really is meaningful to whatever those concerns are on the ground, and demonstrating that our work of health equity can help address those hyper-local needs. And yeah, great, maybe there are lessons that can be shared across community, but I really think the work lives on the ground in the neighborhood, face-to-face with people. One of the frameworks is the vital conditions for health and well-being. Mm-hmm. And so we lift up that framework as a way to talk about health equity, not just as a fair and just opportunity to thrive, but very specifically what that means vis-a-vis this framework that says we want all communities to have humane housing and opportunities for meaningful work and reliable transportation, right? So these broad domains, these fundamental building blocks of health that actually provide that opportunity. At the center of that vital conditions for health and well-being framework, where it ties all of this health justice work together, right? Because health justice is a policy and practice agenda. It is changing systems and structures to create these new fair and just avenues for health. At the heart of that model is civic muscle and belonging. And so civic muscle is about collective action. It's about civic engagement. It's about being involved. It's not just about voting, but it is about voting. And so if we are to really exercise our collective strength, I would say policies in general that strengthen our ability to flex our civic muscle are key. And I am worried that we are moving away from the strength of some of those policies.
What's the definition of belonging to you personally?
I'll answer this very personally, feeling at ease in a place and space. Right? And so as a gay man with a young son, there are places we don't go on vacation, right? You get off at a new metro stop and there's that automatic looking over your shoulder. So for me, I feel that I belong when I am accepted as me without having to do any gut checks to make sure that's true.
I love how you said that that's important to this movement. And I don't know if belonging is the first thing that people think about when they think about this.
I don't want to give too much credit, but I'll just say it. There's a lot of like genius on the side of folks who are against this work, right? And one of kind of the dastardly geniuses is to erode belonging, right? And to divide and to make it clear that no, we all don't belong in the same places and spaces. In fact, we have to be assigned to our own. And I think that kind of division is what has allowed that false narrative of the zero-sum game to thrive, right? That there's some finite pool of health. If we reinforce this message that we want equal outcomes, and if there's a finite pool of health, that necessarily means that some community is going to have to lose for other communities to gain. And I think when we don't have that sense of belonging, when we don't realize that we are all in one community, right? One national community, one global community, when we are divided in that ways, we end up finding different straw people and different scapegoats, right? To pin how we're feeling in these difficult times. And so I think belonging is key. That value of others is key. And then coming together again to flex that civic muscle through volunteerism, through protest, through voting. When that is eroded, and I do think it is eroding, when that is eroded, it becomes this goal that we have of all communities just having a chance to be healthy. It moves us so much further away from that goal.
I know you mentioned the importance of measurement, and there are some schools of thought that believe that it's impossible to have measurement for this type of work. So let's dive into measurement and what you see as opportunity in those areas.
Now we're going to nerd out. I do love talking about measurement. One of the things that I lift up in the paper is that traditionally, and for very good reasons, the way that we track our progress, right, towards this goal of no unjust, unfair differences in health is we look at disparities metrics. We look at the gap and we kind of quantify how far group A is away from group B. Yeah. The risk of that is that it reinforces that message that someone's got to lose and someone's got to win. Mm-hmm. So I do not think we should abandon that disparity surveillance. I think it's really important to evaluate the success of our programs, to identify where unjust gaps exist. We need that kind of measurement. But I think it can't be the only kind of measurement when it comes to health equity, because the goal of health equity isn't that there are no differences in health between groups. Yeah. Right? The goal is there are no unjust differences in health between groups. And so not every group difference is unjust. A large chunk of most of them, maybe that's true, maybe it is, but that assumption that we're going to get to zero delta between group A and group B, I don't know that that really is the mathematical reality of what health equity is. So what I suggest is that we think about ways to tap into and to measure opportunity, right? If our goal is to create opportunity, we should measure opportunity and not just the difference. And I think that has the added benefit of doing something that our health equity team has not been very adept at doing, and that's tapping into how people are feeling. Mm. Right? So there's this amazing poll by the Frameworks Institute, came out, I think, in 2024, that found that 70% of adults in the U.S. believe, quote, the system is rigged. Right? 70% of Democrats, 70% of Republicans, 70% of white folks, black folks, brown folks. Mm-hmm. Now, do we have differences in why we think the system is rigged or how or who's doing the rigging? Yes. Yeah. But we all have this feeling that we don't have that fair and just opportunity, economic opportunity, health opportunity, educational opportunity. And I think, again, some of that cleverness on, quote unquote, the other side is there the amazing ability to tap into those feelings, mm-hmm. right? And to create movements based on that feeling. So I don't have the exact set of new metrics proposed. I would love, let's work on that together. Actually, let's get a group together and think that through. And there are some organizations, again, like We in the World, actually has a community developed set of measures of well-being that have informed over the years healthy people. And some of those metrics have jumped from the We in the World community kind of collaborative into the federal government's tracking of the health of the nation. So that's another example from that organization. I think about healthcare measures and patient satisfaction, right? What would it mean to, in addition to communication and trust and important measures of perceived care quality, what about perceived opportunity? Did you feel that when you came into this healthcare setting, you had the same chance to get the highest quality care as your richest neighbor? Mm. I mean, yeah. I'm not saying that's the real question, but again, that begins to tap into, and I think a lot of people from all different races, all different backgrounds, all different geographies would maybe answer no to that question. Mm. Well, what kind of common ground to build on does that present? Right? Yeah. So again, we might not have agreement on the mechanisms or the solutions, but that rigged poll, that's 70%. And our center, again, has done lots of public opinion polling where we have found so much cross-ideological, cross-racial agreement on the kinds of policies and the kinds of community conditions that would create health equity, even if we didn't call it that. 75% of self-identified conservative members of Generation Z said that healthcare should be a human right. Mm. That's a sea change. I really do agree, and I really do believe that there's more that unites us than divides us. And through our measurement and our framing, we have to do a better job lifting that up and building different coalitions and doing that hard work of, okay, we agree on one place. Now we have to figure out how we think about processes and solutions where we do have very significant divides.
Do you think that storytelling has a role to play in this? Because even with the example that you mentioned of saying, when you walked in this healthcare setting, did you feel like you had the same opportunity as your richest counterpart? That changes the game and the perspective and the lens that a person looks through it, right? Because in academia, we can use these words that really don't necessarily mean a lot to people who are outside of the sphere. So how do we make it real? How do we make the numbers more tangible and have impact to people who might not see themselves in the language or the words that we're using? But when we use stories or we use questions like that, that really allows a person to really identify and see themselves in what we're talking about.
Strongly endorse. Couldn't have said it any better. Stories are sticky, right? Mm. And they're sticky because they tap into emotion and they make somebody feel something in the way that a data table is, much to my chagrin as an epidemiologist, a data table is never going to make somebody feel anything, right? Yeah. But a story can. And anecdotes are unbelievably powerful. I've been in this work for 25 years and it has taken me 20 of those 25 years to counter my mother's stories about the importance of this work. She grew up in this kind of unique, idyllic space, and maybe for her, with her rose-colored glasses, you know, all of her best friends in high school were Black. All of them turned out to be very successful. She just didn't understand the need for this work because of her own personal stories, right? And so they're sticky both when you hear someone else's stories, and they're sticky for you yourself. That's your N of one, right? Your observation is powerful. In addition to analysis and measurement, storytelling is unbelievably important to change these narratives, 100%.
How do you think that we as health equity advocates can maintain momentum and hope during times like this?
Oh, I wish I had the magic wand of hope. I really do. We have to be realistic. These are and will continue to be very challenging times. But I can say where I draw my hope from. And that is, you know, I'm a population health scientist. Population health work, health justice work, justice itself, very famous quotes about it, right? Long arc. They have a long arc. If any of us got into this field thinking we're going to make quick, immediate change, and we learn that lesson real quick. So this dance of justice, this dance of population health, there are steps forward and steps back. There are leaps back. And I think we're leaping back right now, right?
Yeah.
But I'm also mindful that the success of those whose values, stated values, run counter to our own, they have achieved the success they've achieved over decades and decades and decades. This is also a long game for them. What gives me hope is thinking about the long game for us. Past my time, how do we lay foundations now at the hyper-local level that will pay off at the state and federal level in the next generation? And that's why I'm so passionate about community engagement, so passionate about community organizing. I think we, as scientists and healthcare providers, need to learn some big lessons from our community organizing friends. We need to bring in that knowledge. We need to learn some big lessons from our communication scientists, from our marketers, from political scientists, from folks that have studied the fall and rise of governments and mindsets, and not just ourselves and our go-to community partners. We need to expand those community partners and expand the interdisciplinary nature of our thinking to meet this moment. And so all of that future work really excites me.
I love your focus on that, because sometimes looking in the present can feel very daunting and dark and despair. But like you mentioned, really focusing on the long term and generations to come. And even if we don't get to see it in our current generation and what's happening, realizing that we are laying the foundation and the impact that that will have. I just saw a fashion show from New York Fashion Week, and Ruby Bridges walked in the fashion show, and I was like, I remember writing book reports on her,
right?
Desegregating schools, and we're here on this earth together at the same time, and I'm living as an example of what she paved the way for. So it's similar to what you just said, you know, about what feels daunting and hard right now, but thinking about those long-term impacts.
Yep.
And for you, with this work that you do, obviously it's who you are. You even just alluded to your mother not even understanding the importance of the work that you do. So have there been other examples or experiences in your life where you were able to expand the understanding of other people who might have been skeptical about the importance of health equity? Because you even mentioned in your piece that you feel like it's the responsibility of other white people to have these conversations because you can be heard more. So are there personal examples where you feel like you've had those conversations and been able to at least sow a seed of knowledge to someone?
In my mom's defense, Ashley, she has come around and her eyes are open. She gets it. Her friends from high school are very relieved that I finally broke through. I will say not as many opportunities as I want because, again, the way that our society is structured, I live in my bubble, in a place shared mindsets. Yeah. I work in a place with shared ideals and values. But I will say this. So my husband comes from a huge family. The branches of the family tree span all ideological zones. Yeah. Certainly my twig is maybe furthest to one direction on that tree. But so they have this huge family reunion every year, like 80 of them from all the branches come together. The last year I went, which was not this past year, but the summer before, I had a very long conversation with someone in his family from the other side of the tree, let's put on, in terms of the political spectrum of the tree, where we ended up agreeing, and I thought this was a tremendous breakthrough, was the centrality of community for their worldview. And how that definition, the way that they defined community, and all the things that I said that I wanted for that community, again, going back, humane housing, reliable transportation, belonging, there was a strong endorse on all of those things. Mm. Now again, even if we differ on how we get there, or again, the zero-sum nature of getting there, and we didn't broach that, we found this common ground on, you know what, if that's what you're after, Philip, if that's what you're hoping for, that all communities, including my own, have those basic fundamental things, then yes, then I'm with you. And so maybe the next sentence I would have said would have been like, what? Back up. Nope, I'm not with you anymore. But at least at that moment, we had that common ground. And I think that's what we have to start doing. As you noted, I wrote, I do think there's a special onus on kind of white health equity champions to start trying to build these uncomfortable bridges. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's fair to put our black and brown colleagues in harm's way or put them in unsafe spaces where they feel they don't belong, where they're looking over their shoulder to have those conversations. I had this fantasy of starting a not-for-profit called the Daves. I had these two brothers-in-law, two white brothers-in-law who get this and who understand it and who are from military families and deeply red states. How do we activate those folks to have just low-key conversations where some of these little truths are dropped in? Like, how do we actually begin to activate folks that we're not activating? That's my new nonprofit, the Daves.
I love it, the Daves. So, all listeners who are listening to this, what's just one actionable step to advance health equity? Like you said, specifically in their own community, maybe it's not even their community, maybe it's their family, their household. What would you say would be a start or just some effort towards what we're trying to achieve?
Keep listening. Right? I urge your listeners to keep listening, not just to this podcast, but listening, listening without rebuttal, right? Without judgment, without tokenism, just listen to concerns, whether or not they resonate with you, whether or not you believe they're valid, whether or not you find them offensive. Like, just listen. One of the things our Center for Health Justice has put a lot of time and investment in is co-creating this Principles of Trustworthiness Toolkit. And we just, maybe 2 months ago, kind of refreshed it with input from four new communities that we asked, test it out and play around with it. And the very first lesson that we learned from these four communities from across the country, so California, Nebraska, Illinois, and Georgia, was that there were communities that felt so little belonging, that felt so little social cohesion, that felt so little trust in organizations and institutions, that they weren't even ready yet to talk about trust. Mm-hmm. It was too raw and that was too much. So these community partners created what they called speak freely sessions, where institutions with power and privilege could just come into a community space and just listen. And just without saying a single word back, just listen and then really do that next step of reflecting on what themes are bubbling up and where can you begin to find connections. And so I would say just keep listening.
I'm Ashley Freeman, and thanks for listening to this episode of Advocates in Action. If you haven't yet, please subscribe, review, and share this podcast. Your support is greatly appreciated. We enjoy connecting with our listeners, so please visit our website for show notes, resources, and ways to engage with us on social media. Thanks for listening.